one can see.
Oh,
Oh,
we
the
are live.
stream is
We
live.
are.
So,
Hey guys, hey Dan, hey Billy, how's it going, guys?
Doing good,
Fantastic.
Robert.
All right. Good to
Thank
be
you
here.
for joining here. And in 6 days, we're going to be seeing you here in person. Actually, we're going to see you guys earlier. You're coming in a day early. And it's really amping up, and we're super excited to have you in Sedona. Is this your first time to Sedona, Billy?
This will be my second time in Sedona. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I did a stage show in Sedona probably like 5 years ago with George Norrie.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And you were here last year, Dan. What's your take on Sedona and how you like Sedona?
Sedona's nice. It's a very nice town. Very it's extremely picturesque. You're not going to get an Uber. That is the one thing that did. There's a high enough population. I expected there to be Ubers, and there wasn't. But it's a really it's beautiful. I loved the town, and was surprised at just how we have these towns up in the west coast of Washington that are the same way, where they keep the billboards are all kept down low to the ground. And I noticed it there in Sedona that McDonald's arches are teal. And that's a dead giveaway. If they don't let them have the golden arches, it's one of the things where the city's like, you know what, buddy? And just the sound, it's everything. It's beautiful. It's very much a hippie town. If you run into a druggie there, it's not going to be some homeless person. It's going to be some pothead that's all like peace, love, and rock and roll. So,
yeah, that's true. That's true. What was your experience like, Billy?
It was pretty good. It was cold. It wasn't winter. I remember I came into this really small airport, and the snow was, you know, I guess the trucks had gone through, and the snow was stacked up almost as tall as me on the sides. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. So I didn't go outside that much. You know, I spent most of my time inside and going back and forth to the venue for a couple of days. And then, you know, I got out of there. But the people were phenomenal. Great people. Everyone was just really, really nice. And yeah. I was looking forward to doing another one, but it got delayed because I think he had got amped up with some filming with Gaia or whatever. But it was great. Great experience, and great to spend some time with a living legend like George Norrie, you know. And I could always look back. It's probably the third or fourth time I had a chance to work with him. Yeah, so it was pretty good.
Well, maybe you guys could give a little quick synopsis of what you're going to be covering, and maybe just dab a little into the topic on the second Sphinx and what you think about that. We're going to have a panel the first night welcoming everybody. What's your guys' talks going to be on?
Yeah. You want to go first, Dan, or you?
Sure. Thanks, Billy. I'm going to be talking about elongated skulls, the practice of artificial cranial deformation, the scientific cover-up, which is happening. Like, you don't usually hear me say those kinds of terms. I'm not super conspiratorial, but you know, you also ain't gonna pull the wool over me too many times. At a certain point, it's like when they flat out tell you they have the information and they're not telling you where you can find it because you ain't got the right letters next to your name, that's, I call that a cover-up. And so we're talking about that some, and about how basically, there was like this. This is some of the strongest evidence that I've come across of old world to new world contact in prehistory, and it's solid evidence in my opinion. And that'll also be talking a little bit about the cover up. Or excuse me, not the cover up, but the sale and antiquities theft and looting of those skulls, I guess you could call it. I mean, antiquities might be the right term, but anyway, that's basically what we're going to get into. How about you, Billy?
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'll be talking about ancient texts. So I'm going to go into a lot of the different ancient texts. I'll be going into, of course, some of the common ones that most people have heard me mention before, like the Enuma Elish and the Seven Tablets of Creation, the Epic of Atrahasis, the Code of Hammurabi, the Myth of Adapa, the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, the Indian Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Battle of the Ten Kings, and just also some of the other star lore from some of the ancient cultures, like the Hopi and the Terror Papers, and also some of the star lore from the ancient from the Aboriginals that has been handed down since ancient times, verbally handed down, and kind of just paint a picture a little bit about the like this timeline of this the cultures all having similar situations, similar catastrophes, similar wars, and also building similar structures. And then I'm also going to talk into how is that linked to our consciousness and humanity's hidden origins. Like, you know, I don't believe that any aliens made people. That's one thing I think is a big misconception out there. Just because people, I don't think they really fully listen to, or plus we're getting a lot of clips that are only 1 minute long, so nobody goes to find the whole podcast. But I do want to talk about what I think the origins of mankind are, how we evolved to this level that we are today, how many potential cycles, you know, that we've gone through, yuga cycles on this earth, and a little bit about maybe going into this fifth age. So it's going to be a great talk. I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah.
Yeah. On the Hopi, we have a lot of elders out here. I can get you in touch with Billy if sometimes you want to do some interviews with them. Malava was going to be here and come in and talk with you on a slot on Sunday. And he's not going to be able to make it. He's having eye surgery.
Okay.
But Marco Roden is going to be joining us. So Marco Roden will be filling in that place. But yeah, in the future, you know, anytime you want to get in touch with some elders out here, we can make that happen.
Yeah, that would be beautiful. I'd love to interview some of the Hopi elders. The last two times I sat with the Hopi elders, they had some secrets that they shared with me that they didn't want me to, you know, to express or show. I'd love to sit with some though and say, like, what is it that you can tell me that I can bring, some of it that I can bring to the world, and if not all of it. There are some more secrets. They have incredible knowledge and incredible star lore and handed down history that I would love to, you know, express some of it with respect to them, you know, and not showing what they don't want me to show, whatever. Those things I don't have a problem with at all. But if you can have me sit down with some again, I'd love to do that, you know, because, man, it's just like it's a wealth of knowledge. When you sit down with these people, man, you just get so much information. I just came back from an outback hike. I hiked about 67 miles in the outback. I took people on tour to Australia, and we went out to visit the Aboriginals. And we were down in this basin, and we spent hours with them and singing and dancing and eating indigenous foods and listening to how they tell their star lore and their history through music. And then talking with the elders and getting the wisdom and going to some of the ancient and the sacred sites on the edge of cliff faces overlooking the jungle. And this wisdom that they give you is like, it's just mind-boggling. So wise, so incredibly knowledgeable, so in tune with nature and the universe as a whole. It's mind-boggling. The wisdom is overwhelming, you know. It was one of the greatest trips I had ever been on, spending this last, a few months ago, just spending this time with the Aboriginals in the outback was just mind-blowing. A very spiritual experience, you know.
Yeah, I love Australia. I've been a few times and didn't get out to the outback. I was mostly on the coast, but I really love the stories that come out of there. With 60,000 years history, there's got to be some value there.
Yeah. And,
you know, thinking about Australia, do you guys think that civilizations reach this like glorious peak of technology advancement and it goes so far and goes so fast, kind of like what we're experiencing now, that it just maybe implodes on itself and sends us back to being cavemen, cave people, to start all over again?
Definitely. You know, when I think about alien stuff skeptically, like that's one of the things that I often will say is I believe that aliens exist, but have the funnel for them to get the tech together and then reach us is pretty strong. And we're kind of living that right now, where we're at this point where we're on the cusp of getting that technology, of getting that ability to really outstrip our abilities, our faculties as humans. But at the same time, we're still arguing over whose God's the strongest, and we can't. I mean, we get a virus and the whole fucking world tears itself in half. Go, oh my God, what are we gonna do? We can't.
Got to get the toilet paper.
Thank you. We can't organize on a damn thing. Not one. And so it's like, the ancients definitely talked about, it's the story. That's one thing you can definitely see over and over and over again. It doesn't matter if you're talking Native American or Australian or European or African, mm-hmm. when they talk about the world getting smote by the gods, it's always hubris. It's always the man got too big for his britches, and he built a tower to reach the gods in the case of the Tower of Babel, or in the case of Atlantis, he just got too cool for himself, or in the case of the Great Deluge in the Bible, he was too busy screwing the giants. And but it always comes back to the same thing. We just went too far. So yeah, I think there's a pretty good chance that, but a lot of that's that we've been in down that kind of road before, but you know, then you really have all you have to go off in the record is the words. There's nothing that I see that makes me okay. I guess there's small things like your little Tully Majets as a good example of something where mm-hmm. you're like, well, okay, here's a whisper of something. Sure is uncanny that they managed to put the tail in the right spot in an airplane. That's not. It took a lot of trial and error before they got that down. If you look at the history of flight, they didn't just figure out you put a tail on an airplane. So it's, yeah. Anyway, I can play both sides of that coin if I have to. Ultimately, yeah. I'm a lot more skeptical than Billy is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Billy, I think it's really nice. We have a lot of people in the chat actually, at least on my channel, talking about how it's nice to see these kinds of meetings of the minds of different perspectives. And in all honesty, as we said before, it's really the only way forward. Nobody sees it all.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. You know, there's no doubt. And I really am a firm believer that mankind has risen and fallen many times. This is outside of any belief that I have in these, what they call, quote unquote, the gods coming to earth from ancient times, the Anunnaki, the Anuna, the Netiru, whatever culture wants to call them. Let's move them out of the way for a second. And let's just take a look at, since everything in this universe is a fractal, let's take a look at a fractal of a civilization known as our current civilization. Where were we 100 years ago? 100 years ago, we were in horse, buggy, and carriages, okay? And we went from a horse, buggy, and carriage to, we have Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 in interstellar space. We've got rovers on Mars. We probably have what I call a secret space program. I think these rocket launchers are burning chemical fuel. I think that's just a whole nother aspect of a boring space program. I think there's something even much more sophisticated. And we know this because there's something called black budget projects that the government has had for many years. A lot of people didn't even know about the SR-71 Blackbird. Now we have the SR-72, which is probably twice as fast as the SR-71. But look at that, 100 years from a horse, buggy, and carriage to putting probes into interstellar space and sending the Huygens probe to Titan and going to missions to Mercury and taking those incredible images of the Mercury, but also getting a sample of Mercury's atmosphere. Russia put the Venus 1 through 14 as Venus missions and actually landed on Venus and transmitted back photo and video. We've done a lot in only 100 years. And now we have the quantum computers. We have a quantum computer that just solved a problem that would have taken every computer on Earth potentially millions or maybe even billions of years to solve. It did it in a few minutes. So that when they went to research how it solved it, they found out that this quantum chip went into the multiverse to bring the answer back. That was Google. So we're like, wait a minute, now we have AI. AI is becoming ASI, then, you know. So what is going on here? This advancement bell curve is like incredible. And that's in just this tiny fractal of time. And Earth has been here for billions of years. So if you go back to different iterations of mankind and just span out and say, what if a civilization had a chance to progress for, you know, 1 million years unimpeded? what would it look like? What if a civilization had a chance to progress 500,000 years unimpeded? So I think that there have been several rises and falls, and I think the combination could be part of us getting in our own way. Maybe we didn't survive a particular previous nuclear age or something similar, right? Or we annihilated ourselves. But also, space is a very violent place. I mean, it's violent. And the fact that we're living in this window of time where there's relative peace around our solar system is miraculous. And so, but you, the further you go back in time, especially if you read the Enuma Elish, you begin to see all these things colliding, planets colliding into moons and moons crashing into planets and debris floating around everywhere, crashing into other planets and just wreaking havoc. And now we've got the evidence on the moon. We can see all those pot marks. We can see Jupiter absorbing a lot of treacherous comets and asteroids that would have normally trended down towards the sun, maybe even impacted us. So we're living in a small window of glory right now. This is kind of a golden age for the solar system in peace. And the thing I believe that we have to do now that we're kind of on this way back up, we got to get spiritually connected back to what we're doing and technologically. We got to combine those two things together. We need more conscious creators within tech and aerospace. And we also have to learn how to manifest heaven on earth. And the only way to do that is for conversations like this to occur. You know, for us to have maybe some slightly opposing opinions, but can still work together and find some common ground and forget about the divide and conquer tactics, red, blue, and all these different things. My skin reflects sunlight different than your skin reflects sunlight. All these stupid things that are going on out there, they try to keep us apart, and just come together and network together and build together while we have this sliver of time that we don't even know how long this window is going to last. And maybe there'll be a crash in this window and through geological or whatever, and then there'll be another cycle. But right now, according to the Hopi, we're heading into the fifth age. So this is the beginning, I believe, of something great.
Yeah, the old saying, those who forget their history or don't know history are doomed to repeat it. It seems like it's an important blueprint to like have for your immediate future navigation, you know, to like see what the past has to offer, because the Hopi prophecy rock, it has those two paths, and the humans are going on this path of destruction, and then there's this other group that takes another path, and that seems to be a reoccurring theme over and over again throughout history as well. Do you guys go ahead, Dan?
Well, I was just going to say really quick that like the focus on the stars is something that like when we're talking about working together with differing viewpoints and stuff, the focus on the stars is one thing that you'll notice a lot of people in the alternate history community agree on. And the, you know, I like to bring up that, you know, there's spiders out there. There's the dung beetle navigates with stars. And so if that stupid freaking bug is figuring it out, I'm certain that Neanderthals were doing the same. You know, when recently they were talking about the oldest writing in human history, and and we had, you know, some unsavory people came up out of the woodwork because it was in Germany. So it's like, ah, ha, ha. But the thing is, we already had all these old writings. Like they call it an artificial memory system, right? It's an something external to record data. And in Aubrey Blanchard in France, they found this bone that, like, from the since the 70s, they've been talking about it. And it's got a pattern of like this on it that not only depicts different phases of the moon, but it depicts those phases as it would appear from sitting in that spot and recording it. We've got, and this is like 40,000 years old. And wow. So, and this is not quite accepted, but it's not hotly debated. It's about as accepted as something that's not completely accepted can be in archaeology. And so the fact of the matter is stars were exceptionally important, and it's something that we know, like, I mean, I hate to invoke this guy, but Flint Dibble, for example, says that the Sphinx facing due east is just happenstance. And it's like, anybody, I don't care if you're a complete atheist or if you're a complete solar nut job,
yeah,
The things facing due east, if you study the past, you're going to be aware that this was a big freaking deal to the ancients. It's like you don't have to. What's his face said it? H.P. Lovecraft said it pretty good. Says, I don't need to believe in Santa Claus to understand that people exchange gifts on December 25th. Right? It's, you know, I don't need to believe it in order to play the game or to understand the game. So I think it's really important and something that it's sadly our corner that really does it. You know, Hugh Newman from Megalithomania is a great example. He's hammering at that. Him and JJ all the time are just hammering at archaeoastronomy in ways that the mainstream seems afraid to do for whatever reason.
Yeah, they're real experts at it, man. They're real experts. They go in, and Hugh, man, he's, you know, I've been following Hugh and friends with Hugh for quite. I gave Hugh Newman an award at my Conscious Awards a couple years ago, you know, for his work in archaeology and research in the field and field researcher in these ancient sites because of the dedication, you know, to his craft and how much energy him and JJ put into it. It's just monumentous, you know. And I love that. But yeah, it's really all about, we're passionate about this stuff. You know, we're so passionate. And for the average person, you know, they've got a lot of other things that they do. But for us, this is like one of our main things. And I love it so much that I've been traveling around the world. I've been around the world now 25 times as of coming back from this trip from Australia. And there's no other way I'd like to live my life. I mean, I spend 8 to 9 months a year in hotels. I'm always out in some desert, some field, some jungle somewhere getting bit up or whatever. But man, I just absolutely love it. I can't think of any better way to spend life doing these things and discovering this stuff and seeing things that hardly anybody will ever see, discovering things that hardly anybody will ever discover that go against the mainstream narrative. And some of it may get to the top and some of it may just stay within this little circle of understanding. And that's okay. It's really still about, I think, you know, what we're doing here is really, we're really trying to spread the word, get the information out and give people enough data so that they can make their own educated decisions. And I think, I go along with you, Dan, you know, and Robert, it's like, don't believe what we say, research what we say. Everyone's got their own path, right? And I think there's 101 ways to enlightenment. And I think as long as we can continue to provide data points, which is really what we're giving, data points, to make hypotheses. We're trying to piece together all the pieces of the puzzle and connect the dots. And I think we're helping people connect the dots. And a lot of people are coming up with their own ideas, their own understandings, their own hypothesis. And then they themselves then become researchers and they become passionate and it's duplicatable and they keep spreading. I think ultimately that's the real goal here is to get more people out here looking and digging up this information and talking about it, you know?
You know, I couldn't have said that better myself. It's actually one of the things when I admonish the science educators on Twitter, I frequently will point out, it's like you guys all the time just put a wet blanket on some, like Jimmy Corsetti one time was saying, he's like, you know, maybe the Nephilim was, in the Bible was a reference to Neanderthal or maybe Denise Evans. And so instead of like all these guys come and yell and they're like, oh, but those were smaller than humans and that the Neanderthals were smaller and the Bible says the Nephilim were bigger. And it's like you had the opportunity to say, hey, man, there's other species of hominid that were larger. You could check it out like Gigantopithecus and therefore take his passion and you send it into a research hole, into going and looking, or instead they throw a wet blanket on it. So it's by default falls on people like us in order to just keep that, even just on a basic scientific inquiry, go look at how many and ask archaeologists how many of them got into it because of Atlantis, Indiana Jones. It's no surprise that they all run around with their dusty fedoras and leather jackets like Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones didn't go around radiocarbon dating seeds and doing stratigraphy. All right. He went around grabbing cool shit that got stashed in secret places come on, man. But they piss all over that. So sorry, but yes, what you were saying is so dead on with the current situation. It falls on us. The universe gave us this job, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Facts. Yeah, man.
Well, and the older traditional societies, like take the Maori, for example, they can recite their history back generations. And we don't seem to have that in our modern world. It's up to us to figure it out ourselves. No one's there to drop it on you or pass on the baton.
That's so true. Yeah.
And you were talking about the Star-Lord, Dan. I remember in Peru, maybe you've been there, Billy, in Vilcabamba, the white rock. It's this big carved rock. There's lots of big giant stones laying around. Who knows what it was?
Yeah.
But on the back side, you see the horizon where all the stars come up and everything. And I was looking at these stones, and they seemed to be cut. They were all jagged and everything, but they seemed to be cut that way, not just by, you know, random accident. And the guy there was telling me, look at that. We came up there at night. There was a full moon. He goes, look at the ridge. See this cut? It's the horizon over there.
Wow.
Then they had a big pool where they would have water, and then you can see all the star systems in the water.
Amazing.
So it's that important to them that, you know, that carving that stuff and putting that together isn't really that simple.
Yeah. But these people were smart. They were smart. There were a ton of these people were super intelligent. And think about it, though. They didn't have smartphones. Smartphones are making us more dumb. So, you know, they had to pay attention to the stars. They had to, you know, we know that they figured out cardinal points. We know that they were able to navigate the seas with a sextant. We know that they had these capabilities, but it might have been they had these capabilities because they didn't have smartphones. You know, they couldn't just look on Google for every answer or get on now or ChatGPT now for an answer. Just like when we were all, the three of us here, where we were younger in school, we had to know the answers to the damn questions. We couldn't get on a device or go on the air button, you know, ask it and get it back in our ear. We had to know the answers. Well, then go back then, they really had to know the answers because it was about survival at that point. We're in an age called modern, so survival pretty much is almost guaranteed, right? With the exception of a few crazy situations you can get into. But for the most part, there are no wild animals coming to attack us and things like that. And food is at a corner store. Hunting, gathering has been turned into something totally different. But back then for them, man, I mean, you know, it's amazing what the mind can do and what wisdom you can gather, what observations you can make simply by being completely immersed in what's necessary just to survive.
That's, I completely agree. A great example, I talk about this a lot, where I think if we watch the pyramids get built today, we wouldn't be going, oh my God, we'd be going, oh really? That's how, why didn't I think of that? But they worked with, I mean, by mainstream history, you know, stone was the premier building material for like 2 million years, literally. So, and then all of a sudden we switched to metal, and, you know, to give an example of how quick these things can get lost, at World War II, the U.S. had these impromptu, off-the-book sniper schools all over Europe and Asia. And that were the first thing when the belt started getting tightened at the end of the war, it was the first thing to go were these sniper schools. Yeah. So 20 years later in Vietnam, the Brazos come getting all these reports from the NCOs, we need trained snipers in the field. Their first generation of trained snipers in for the sniper schools in the Vietnam War were trained by a U.S. Olympic marksman. We lost that much knowledge in 20 years' time. Better tools, worse results. So what you're saying is dead on. It's when we as we switch things, as we no longer navigate by the stars, as we no longer remember the songs of our ancestors, there's the old story of Thoth coming to Ra and saying, hey, check it out, I've invented this elixir, and it teaches people to remember. He's like, oh, cool, what do you got? And he's like, it's called writing. And Ra's like, what, you idiot? This isn't going to teach them to remember. Right now they remember the names of their ancestors. They sing the songs. Now they're going to put it on a scroll and shove it on a shelf. It's the same argument, and it's the same human issue, the same our technological advancement of those artificial memory systems, which we're still funny to circle back to that. But that really it offers our technology scares us. We know it. All of our dystopian horror comes from us. Not just technology to steer back to like this yin yang thing between us. It's like there's so many people that are so empirical nowadays, and it's like, don't all those horror, What? Why did Skynet decide to zuke all the humans? It made an empirical decision. It looked at it with a cold, heartless, and that's the last thing we want, man. Really, the last thing we want.
Yeah, it utilized a lot of logic. It was like, do we really need them? You know, at the point of like they're just destroying everything, and they might even destroy us. So it became a self-preservation, I think, concept for the machines, you know. And I try to tell people, which was one of the things I'll be talking about. You know, I wrote this book called Fractal Holographic Universe: The Matrix Code Revealed. This became a bestseller. It beat out Michio Kaku for number one in quantum theory and science and philosophy, and it hit number one in fractal mathematics. I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying this book really dives deep into the knowledge and understanding of fractals. And the research that it took me to put this book together, which I started writing that book in 2018, a lot of the research materials from my biggest lecture in 2017 at Contact in the Desert is what I utilized to put into this book. But the fractal holography, or the fractal nature of reality, it just plays out over and over and over again, as above, so below, but also we can find whatever is in the smallest is going to be in the biggest. And so understanding that civilizations also follow that fractal pattern, just like economics, everything you could think of follows this pattern. And we're living in this pattern. And one of the reasons why we keep having this rise and fall and this loss of our memory, like Graham Hancock says, this amnesia is because we keep getting robbed of some of our past inference. And that's an important part of the fractal that we need to see and understand. Because if you're a baby and you're walking past an electric outlet, you won't touch, if the baby tries to touch it, you'll go, no, don't touch that. You'll scream at the baby. You'll tell the baby it's dangerous. And eventually the baby realizes that's danger. Don't touch that. And the baby grows up to a person, to a young adult, and the baby still, today, you and I, we don't touch electric outlets unless we're plugging something in, because we know it will shock us and it will kill us. Well, how do we know that? We knew that from a past inference. The importance of this ancient civilizations is so vital to humanity. It's so crucial to humanity getting to the next level, because we need to piece together what truly potentially could have happened as close as we can get it. We're never going to get it exact because we weren't there. We can only begin to connect as many dots as we possibly can, different hypotheses, different ideas, different concepts, different perspectives. But the main mission is not about getting it 1,000% accurate. The main mission is, what can we learn? What can we learn from back there so that we don't repeat it up here? Because we keep, in some way, we keep repeating that same thing, whatever that is. And this is where the cycle begins again, right? And I think, what if the universe itself, what if the grand experiment within this universe is for it to figure out how many civilizations can rise and get beyond the religious age, get beyond the nuclear age, get beyond the space age and the space wars, and then eventually get to another golden age? And maybe how many of them can stop rising and falling in golden ages, but also then sustain a golden age? Maybe that's the ultimate goal. And I think that the only ones that can sustain a golden age are the ones who figure out what the hell happened in their past and learn from it, and take that L as a learning lesson, not a loss, and then project that to future decisions and future actions so that we can build a better future for humanity. I think if we did that, we'd have a chance of getting back to a golden age and maybe sustaining it. That's why I'm so passionate about this ancient stuff. I really feel like it's a key to a better future for humanity.
Yeah, I agree with you, Billy. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, that's a really interesting way of putting it. It's, the saying that Robert said earlier about those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. There's the cynical extension of that, that those that do know history are doomed to stand by and watch others repeat it. Again, to kind of go back to the public education or whatever, it's like we somehow have to step out of this. Like, no matter how you look at it, we're definitely in this. We repeat the same destructive patterns over and over and over again and expect things to be different. And quite often it's one person. It's like, Like I could go off about how the disinterest of George Washington is one of the reasons America's turned out so great compared to, I mean, the French Revolution was so similar, but Robespierre wanted to cling to power. Washington was like, ugh, ugh. And so, you know, 100 years later, somebody tries to you know, go with for three terms, 150 years later, we're like, yeah, you can do that once, but then we're going to change the rules because you were supposed to honor this man. It's like there was the tone. You know, John Adams tried to get rid of the First Amendment, right? Our second president, and he was like, yeah, that Bill of Rights, that's pesky. So it's, but so my point here is, it's like, you know, we can break these cycles. You know, historically, you have a revolutionary war and you have mass atrocities. You pick one that didn't end that way. The American Revolution, that's about it. There's no other big one that I can think of. It just didn't have reprisal after reprisal after reprisal. Mm-hmm. Even in the American Civil War, where they outlawed that sort of thing, there was quite a bit of blood and guts in the back room. So we can break these cycles, but it takes getting the public on board, and getting the public on board with stuff's finicky. It's a tricky bitch, but otherwise every TikToker would have a billion followers, right?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I wanted to make a comparison of, talking about ancient civilizations, it seems like the Ark of the Covenant, the pyramids around the planet were some kind of energy sources. What's your guys' take on that? Because, you know, how it seems like we're getting to this peak is everyone's fighting over who's going to control the energy. Mm. And whoever controls the energy controls the storyline, the narrative, how things are going to roll out. Yeah. So it seems like it's a race against time for us to figure ourselves out before we get to that peak space. What do you say about that?
Yeah, well, you know, energy is the key. I mean, he who controls the energy and he who controls the space in the upper atmosphere controls the planet pretty much. Energy is a big factor. And it's really so crazy that it's 2026 and we're still driving around in combustion engines and now these, you know, these electric cars, which still use oil, because when you plug it in, it needs oil from the station, the power station down the street that runs off of oil. You know, man, we could have been so far. I was reading a scientific study about a decade ago. They were researching the Arabs back in the 1800s and their technological advancements. And a group of scientists had researched them extensively, and they discovered that their hypothesis was, I should say, that their hypothesis, not discovered, but their hypothesis was based on what they studied and researched, was that if it wasn't for the papal inquisitions, they would have been to the moon in the 1800s. Think about how far behind we are, because people have been suppressing and oppressing different types of advanced technologies, specifically zero point energy, the ability to have an energy local to you that's virtually almost unlimited in some way, right? Or extensive, maybe it can last thousands of years. Because they know that if everyone has power, then the level becomes a level playing field globally. And they don't want that. They want people in a third world state. They want people in a fourth world state. They want people in a second world state energetically, because if everyone's at the top, then it becomes a lot harder to dominate everyone. So everyone's playing field is easy. So you're right about that. The power source is incredible. If you look into, you know, the Great Pyramid, now there is this object inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. They call it a sarcophagus, although based on what you see all throughout Egypt and all the temples I've been to, it doesn't look like a sarcophagus. You know, the way that it's styled and shaped, it looks more like a storage box of some type. If you look at the floor of the King's Chamber, you can see the drag marks. So in some way, I believe it was in the center of the King's Chamber. And at some point in the past, I don't know when, it seems like that rose granite coffer was moved back closer to that side wall there. But if you take the dimensions of it and then look in the biblical text and take the dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant, it actually would fit perfectly inside that box. Now, on one corner of this rose granite box, a huge corner piece is snapped off. It's gone. But if you look in the angle directly in front of where that corner piece is snapped off and look at the wall, the solid crystal granite walls that are impeccable, there's a gigantic corner piece that's kind of just cracked out, which matches the corner piece of the box about 20 feet away. In my opinion, again, this is my own hypothesis, I think that there was some type of energetic buildup, and whatever that was, boom, that corner piece couldn't handle the energy. It flew off and hit that corner part of the King's Chamber, damaged the crystal granite perfect slabs in the wall. And I think that that chamber could have been a chamber for fusion of some type. What type? I'm not sure. I'm only hypothesizing, but I feel like it was a chamber for some type of fusion. You know, when you're inside of the Great Pyramid, a lot of people have these spiritual experiences. I can understand that, because you're standing inside of a dilation bubble, right? Time dilation bubble. You have 2 million blocks of stone there, you know, on top of you. You're inside this area with all this crystal and granite and everything else, and it's ancient. And it's, you know, so all these things, it gives you this spiritual feeling, and also some type of a health benefit. A lot of people experience different types of health benefit, blood pressure drops and things like that. But on the other side, I begin to realize I'm standing inside of a machine. It's like I took an engine block out of my car and I shrunk myself down like Ant-Man and I stepped inside of one of the piston chambers. It's like you're standing in a machine. You get that real, when you put the technological mind on, you really begin to understand you're standing in some type of a multifunctional stone machine. And I really do believe that in some way it generated power in ancient times. And I think it even used hydrogen, because where the queen shaft is located, you can see that when the Nile was closer, when the water used to run, you can see how the water used to flow up and where it would angle down into the queen's chamber, which where if they were generating some type of electricity, they might have used electrolysis to extract the hydrogen atoms from the H2O and then utilize that hydrogen for something else. It could have been used for power, communication, many different things, cold fusion, whatever. But it's just mind-boggling, again, that this was done so many thousands of years ago and we're still trying to figure it out today. Just incredible.
What's interesting about a lot of that, I'm a lot more skeptical of a lot of the ancient high technology claims, but there were, when I looked into this, one thing that was interesting to me was the Ark of the Covenant. The dimensions on the Ark of the Covenant are debated because it's in the old Bible, right? So like we're talking Old Testament days. So they tend to be in the parameters of what would fit inside that sarcophagus. And this is where a lot of people are going to look at me and be like, Dan, I thought you were skeptical about this stuff, but do you know what it takes to actually discover electricity? This is from an electrician. Like you were saying earlier, we don't put our fingers in outlets, buddy. I put my finger in numerous outlets. This is what it takes to discover electricity. Say for instance, you've got a tin pot that you use to put some sort of juice in, maybe lemon juice to pour on your salad, and you take a copper spoon and you put it inside of that pot. You've just created a galvanic cell, the exact same thing that they say the Baghdad batteries were. So All you have to do is maybe touch your lips at the same time to those two things, or touch some sensitive part of your body, open sore, and you're going to notice that shock. And electricity in and of itself isn't a complicated thing for them to have discovered. It's a complicated thing to harness and to use. It kicks the first thing out the gate of they didn't have it like at all. I recently talked about the Baghdad battery. I think that they used that. I don't think they needed to know it made electricity as much as that process. Galvanic cell separates. If you use mine runoff and for the acid of those batteries that had like a bunch of different metals in it, it would separate out the gold and silver and copper from the other metals. So a Baghdad battery could have been, check this part out, is the one part of the metal would actually, that you had like the iron would get smaller, would get pitted, it would rot. And the copper would get a buildup of all these other precious metals. So it would look like alchemy. You would be like, oh, this metal's being turned into this metal. Well, holy sheep right. shit. And the discovery of that, again, it takes dropping an iron nail and a copper coin in a puddle of mine runoff, coming back a week later and pulling out that copper coin and going, wow, look at the gold that's crusted on that thing. Right. So it's not, this isn't, humans discovered cheese, right? I think that was every bit as complicated as to having to have a calf's belly and storing milk in it and going through the day. It takes a bunch of, but so yeah, anyway, I it's not outside of the realm of possibility that we discovered electricity a thousand times over. It's yeah. quite certainly did, but mm-hmm. it's what do we do with it? So,
yeah.
So anyway, this stuff is, I don't think that it was that they did have ancient high tech in there, but you can't put a complete, just they didn't have electricity at all. It's like, well, they didn't have harnessed electricity, but they definitely had electricity.
Yeah. What do you think, Dan, what do you think about the electroplated gold pieces that they found, you know, from ancient times, a lot of electroplated gold pieces, they're in the museums. Do you think they use a gold? Do you think they use the Baghdad battery type of a cell to do the electric gold plating?
I think that's quite possible. The electroplating can be done through a number of chemical means, but the ones that if I remember right, there's only a couple of them, and it was one of those things where, like the cocaine mummies, like anything else, if a real scientist goes in there and discovers something cool, well, nowadays they just disappear the scientists. But back in the day, what they used to do was they discredited the scientists. or the finding. And it seemed like it was the same way when I was looking at those coins, that it was that they were like, well, we don't know for sure that these were electroplated or not. But honestly, the Baghdad battery itself doesn't have a way to get to access both poles. Like if you look at a battery, it's got two poles. The Baghdad battery itself doesn't have a way to access both poles. And again, to circle back to the goofy cover up stuff, you know where the Baghdad battery is now? There's fucking one person that knows where the Baghdad battery is now. The United States government, when the Alphabet Boys showed up, we were all kicking Iraq's ass in like 2006. Mm-hmm. They went into that museum and they were like, and that was on the list of things that just got disappeared. Mark my words, but before our kids are dead, the anti-cancer mechanism will end up on that list. Anything cool, anything anomalous, anything outlandish, and then they can say there's nothing in the record. There's nothing in the record that would imply it. It's like, well, fuck. Can I see the cool guy's shelves? Most of the same. You don't have the wrong, again, with back to the skulls. You have the wrong letters next to your name. Okay. Can't blame me for thinking they're aliens then, now can you, buddy? So you put a big vacuum in, and then they just demonize that with the way, you know, like the scientist thing right now. It's like you're going to be looked at. They've done such a great job of painting people into different corners with that the, you know, the Epstein letters come out, and it's relegated in a lot of people's, that's just crazy uncle shit. That's the stuff my crazy uncle's going to babble about at Thanksgiving. He's like, dude, this is a little bit more important than the moon landing might be fake. Okay. This is just a touch more important than this kind of stuff. But it ends up in that same, that's conspiracy nut bullshit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Brown They're man. Experts at making us go into that spiral and having a lot of people just dismiss things. They really are experts at neuroscience. This is what they do. They're experts at applied neuroscience. They know how to get into the psyche. They know how to do the psyops. They know how to twist a little bit of truth with a lot of bad information. They're experts at it, and they've been doing this so long, and they keep people spinning, plus keeping us so busy with bills and distractions and everything else, you know, so a person doesn't really have time to say, you know, I'm going to dedicate my life to figuring this out. So it just doesn't happen, you know?
Yeah. Well, I remember when the first Iraq war and the invasion. And I remember they went straight to the museum. That was the first place they went. And the question was, why the museum? I mean, the places that you would go, the museum was the first place. So that was one thing I remembered. And then recently, you know, when you brought up space, Billy, and together with energy, I've heard the theory that even the Iraq invasion and the current Iran invasion is about looking for artifacts or star portals to other dimensional space. And if that was actual, you know, then that would be something you would want to control.
Oh, yeah.
What do you guys think about that? Is that too far out there?
It's out there, but, you know, there's some hypothesis that there could be some ancient technology hidden in those mountains that Iran is protecting or keeping away from the world. And, you know, I remember when the Minister for Transportation for Iraq came out, I think it was now maybe, this is 2026. It might have been 5 years ago. You can, it's easily Googleable. You can look it up. The Minister of Transportation for Iraq came out and said that Iraq was the first location of an ancient airport and was one of the most highly technologically advanced areas on Earth in Mesopotamia thousands of years ago, and that they had the proof. And again, that's Iran, Iraq. It's all right there. That was all one part of one place, Persia. And I really do believe that there are a lot of great mysteries to still be discovered down there. Ancient technology, ancient text referencing technology, ancient stones referencing technologies, maybe even cylinder scrolls. And the U.S. government would love to get their hands on that, or any government would, you know, that could produce technology, simply because one of their main reasons and functions for going through a lot of this old stuff, which they go through a lot of ancient texts, is to turn these things into weapons. Just like, you know, remember that quote from what's the gentleman who helped build that the atomic bomb? And he made a quote from the Mahabharata. Oppenheimer,
I have become death, destroyer of worlds.
Exactly, exactly. They know about all this ancient text and all these wars, and they're looking to how they can weaponize any of this tech, or also get it in their hands and get instead of their adversaries' hands. You know, yeah,
yeah. I think a lot of. Again, I'm way less of a believer in ancient high tech, but I do think that they try hard to demonize any searches into anything that's out there at all. And the way that they do it, like we were getting at a minute ago, like it's so, like Billy was saying, they've been doing it for forever. You know, I forget the cartoonist's name, but Napoleon, like the French dude, Napoleon, the Corsican, sorry. But he like we everybody records him as like a short little dude, right? He wasn't short. He was like an inch taller than most of his contemporaries. The thing was, this cartoonist portrayed him as a short little dude, portrayed him as a spoiled little rich kid. And Napoleon said it in his memoirs. He said that this guy did more damage to him than any general ever did on the field. Wow. And that's and that's from an artillery general's perspective. So yeah, I mean, this is that when they play games with this stuff, they stop it. They make you stop looking at things by conflating things. Like you hear it a lot in the Atlantis community. Oh, looking for Atlantis is just as stupid as a flat Earth, and it's like the demonstrable difference in that. You can literally go get in an airplane. If you fly around the world and it's like you watch the sunset, you see the curved face of the Earth. It's not even hard at that point.
Yeah.
But you see the videos of people. You can go buy, spend $1,000, slap a GoPro on a fancy rocket, and you can pop that thing up into the atmosphere yourself. The videos are all over the internet of people doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by the extent, the difference in Atlantis is, well, okay, you could say that we don't have as much evidence as you'd like, so you could say there's a vacuum of evidence. But those two things, is a difference between denying observable reality and wondering if there's a mystery somewhere. And when they conflate those two things, that really is a mental win. You've boxed people, you've Plato's caved somebody all the way down into the deepest of darks. They're afraid to look out. Otherwise, they're that crazy uncle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. So true. Yeah, man.
Did you guys ever, I'm a little bit older than, I don't know how old you are, Dan, but I assume I'm a little bit older.
I'm 50. Old enough, pieces fall off when I run.
I'm 54. I wake up with sleep injuries now.
Oh, damn.
Did you guys ever watch a show when you were a kid called Land of the Lost?
Oh yeah, classic.
Oh come yeah. On.
So it feels like we're now in an Avengers movie or a Land of the Lost, because remember the reptilian, they were back there with dinosaurs, but then there's all this, also this reptilian humanoid, the Slee Stacks.
The Slee Stacks. Yeah.
They have to be aware of. And then these guys have an interdimensional portal that has a pyramid, you know, panel that comes down. And if you put the right crystals in the right place, then you can, you know, interdimensionally travel to another place. And they're trying to use this. They're trying to figure it out how to get back home. But the funny thing is, star portals, crystals, the dinosaurs, reptilians, it's all in a kid's movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it reminds me of the predictive programming. Are we predictive, you know, programmed to have this predictive projections in our minds, or is it out there and they're just seeding us with it when we're young? What's your take on that?
I think, go ahead, Dan.
No, go ahead, Billy. You're fine. Go for it.
I really believe in that. You know, they're the people, the creatives behind a lot of these shows, they do a lot of research to come up with the writing, to come up with the scripting and everything else. You know, I've learned just in being now in production and being an executive producer, being a writer. You know, I wrote season one and two of my TV, my docuseries, and also wrote, co-wrote the Black Knight Satellite documentary. And through that process, the amount of research you do, and you do find little nuggets and things, and you try to kind of hide them within the actual scripting and within the actual show. I believe that a lot of the edutainment that we get, I call it edutainment, in the fictional series are because, and this is just my opinion, a lot of these creatives and these writers, they kind of embed little nuggets here and there, and you know, and maybe even some of it was told to be done, or maybe some of it just kind of slipped in and nobody even noticed. But I do think in an overall overarching type of way that a lot of what we've seen technologically, just looking at the Star Trek series from the 60s, they've been predicting what's coming. They've been pretty accurate.
Yeah, this goes all the way back to, geez, what's that guy's name? In the early 1900s, between World War One and Two, there was Orson Welles. We're talking, or H.G. Wells, excuse me. He had a movie like To the Moon, and they use a space gun, and this gun is this giant articulated cannon, and the dude gets up. Mm-hmm. But he takes this big set of rigging all the way up to the top, looks just like Cape Canaveral, and goes and gets in this thing. It's so much of it is, and the thing is, you know, each generation's influenced by the one before. Like if you look at, go buy an old computer magazine from the 70s, and the number one game was Star Trek, and it was a text game, but it was Star Trek, and you were Captain Kirk flying around and fighting Klingons. And this is where their minds went, because even though I'm skeptical of these kinds of things, I always try to entertain them. Like, I don't know if you guys have heard the 100 monkey theory.
Oh yeah, but
it's okay. Exactly. That for the people who haven't heard it, that's watching, it's basically that when once the 100th monkey would learn how to do something like go fishing with a spear, that all the monkeys just like picked it up through like a unimind type of thing. You know, this is one of the things where science people that are skeptical make me laugh, because it's like if you were to say, well, these bees or these ants work in this unified hive mind kind of thing, they'd be like, oh yeah, okay, no problem. You're like, oh, but maybe birds have this and that's why they fly the way they do, or fish have it, that's why they swim the way they do, or humans have it, and that's, ah, now you're fucking crazy, you goddamn hippie. It's like, whoa, okay. how are these other things doing? Oh, they're doing with chemical signals. Okay, so do you think we might use chemical? No. It's like it gets the empiricism gets.
Yeah.
Ends up being very much what you can see and smell and taste, and it's like even though I'm very skeptical and very atheistic about this stuff, I can get pretty frustrated with the way that it's like denying half of reality. It's strip your goals from things, strip your morality from things, and then see what if there's any reason to not, you know, jump off a cliff, right? The whole point of life is living. I was watching a thing the other day with these damn polar bears. They bump into each other. They're solitary hunters. They bump into each other. They hung out for like 4 hours playing around and sliding on the ice, and then they went their own separate ways, burn all these calories in the freezing ass cold for nothing but fun with a bear they may never meet again. Why? Because it was fun, and they're alive. it's not complicated, man.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, well, speaking of fun, I think it's going to be fun to have you guys all here. We're going to have a little gathering the first day you guys get here. We're going to have a party after we do the mic check at Performing Arts Center. But really looking forward to you guys coming in. We're going to have more great conversations like these. And also, you know, just having all the different types of people coming in from all over the country is really cool. So we're going to have a good party, guys.
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to it. We'll see you there at the Quest for Ancient Civilizations, May 1st through the 3rd, Sedona, Arizona.
Yeah, Sedona is a good town, man. It's a lot of fun. It's small and big all at the same time. It's fun.
Looking forward to it.
And we got a DJ lined up, so we'll have a couple hours Friday and Saturday night with the DJ, and we have some after hours for those people who want to join Dan.
Well, I'm expecting a drink. Oh my God, this is it's gonna be rough. You see what's expected of me out there, people? You got to support this event. Come on. Somebody's got to buy my beer.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of supporting the speakers, Dan and Billy have some designated seats. If there's any fans of Dan or Billy that want to get seats directly from them, you'll be sitting in the Dan Clan section and the Billy Clan section if you want that. So that's available. You get that directly through them to buy those seats, and they have a group rate on those seats as well. So if you haven't got your seats yet and you want to sit in the Dan or Billy Clan section, get in touch with them directly. And otherwise, we're looking forward to seeing all of you out there. We got a great lineup for you, and we got a lot of fun on the side. So.
Yeah.
Looking forward to seeing everyone there, and thank you guys for joining tonight. Really love hanging out and talking with you.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you. Appreciate y'all. Catch y'all later.
Take care. It's good to see you. Thanks so much.
Bye.